Okay, good afternoon, good Erev Shabbos, everybody. Can't believe we're back here again. 2012, whatever that is, Toshi 9 base. As I do from year to year, I like to challenge the Olam. I like to sort of get you to think a bit. You know, I'm not coming here just to sort of share, to teach ideas. I'm here to share ideas. I want you to sort of maybe be very much inspired to think and to deal, and we're going to deal with issues which are really very much on the agenda in the Jewish community around the world. The title of the series is that Head in Heaven, Feet on the Ground. You know, Rosh HaBashamayim V'Regel Al Haaretz, or the expression from the Torah. The idea will be that we'll deal with feet on the ground. We'll deal with some very basic issues, things that happen in everyday life, things to do, for instance, with business, how to handle situation. Copyright, I'm going to talk about, because that's a very interesting topic. I've never spoken about that before. And that's a very challenging topic, and it's with us the whole time. There's a big question about what exactly, according to the Torah, is the law of copyright. It's an interesting thing. Also, Rosh HaBashamayim, the idea of dealing with matters of heaven. In other words, things which are a bit more philosophical in nature. Things like miracles we'll be talking about. And hopefully there'll be some interesting interaction there, because everyone has a story to tell, I'm sure. So that's the plan. The plan will be to kind of vary the diet over the next 2 weeks, and I'm starting with the basics. So I want to deal today, obviously thinking of the parasha, and thinking of Parsha Balak with Bilam and the donkey. We can already start talking about the whole question of animal rights. It's almost an obvious reference from the parasha to try and come to terms with our attitude towards animals. All right, Bilam clearly did not have great respect for his animal, and he hits the animal shalosh regalim, it says, right? You know, it's an interesting thing. He really kicks it. He kicks it three times. We see there that he's clearly the example not to follow. Okay, the fact that he can talk to the donkey, that's a whole separate discussion. But I don't want to go into now. What I want to mention, which is to me a very serious issue around the world, many of you come from experiences from countries where you will know firsthand that the first thing when a government turns against the Jewish population, what do they ban? Straight away, shechita. It's almost guaranteed. In Poland in the 1930s, that was the first thing that the anti-Semitic government rules came out. And obviously the Nazis did it. This is something that we've had in Jewish history over and over again. And the shocking thing is that in the 21st century in Holland, at the moment the debate is, yet again, whether shechita should be banned. And I don't know if you've been following the news, some of you who read Hamodia or some of the Jewish newspapers, you'll see that the debate in Holland is very, very difficult. There is a small Orthodox community there which is fighting to preserve shechita against a very, very serious attack by, I don't know what you would call them, animal rights people who are supposedly sort of fighting to protect the whatever kind of philosophical idea they have about the animal world. You know, there are some strange connections going on there.
You have it in Switzerland.
And Switzerland is already, Schiet has been banned. That was banned ages ago. And Sweden also was banned. And it's going around Europe, and I really believe that where I come from, the UK, is not going to be far behind. I don't think it's going to take that many years before in England the animal rights lobby, as they are called in the UK, will have the sway of the legal system. They know how to work the system, and they will ban shechita in England as well. And it's coming slowly, sort of closer and closer. Maybe, you know, your grandchildren may be living in a world where the only place where shechita will be freely practiced is the United States, obviously in Israel. But around the world, in Europe particularly, it is now very much under scrutiny. And this is very worrying, because you say to yourself, what is their agenda? What is the agenda of people who really, you know, love animals, let's say, more than they love anything else? Yes. And Poland again, and if you read this week, something which was even shocking, though it's not quite connected to this, is that in Germany, of all places, and you would think that the Germans learned the lesson, there's now a court in Dusseldorf which just came out with an edict forbidding bris milah, forbidding circumcision. And in a country which has been so famous and infamous is probably the better word, for and also here in San Francisco. But there it's sort of, you know, taking over the country, as it were, became kind of a national issue. Here, I don't know how many people heard about it from West Coast to East Coast, but the Jewish community was aware of it. And these things, you know, and I'm concentrating down on the animal side of things. It's very disturbing. It's very worrying. And it's yet again a manifestation of something which, you know, we probably don't have to be told what's behind a lot of this. The muzzle today, which is a strange concept, is that the other group of people which are affected by this, not quite in the same way, are the Muslim population. And the Muslim population is much bigger than the Jewish population, even in America. Possibly not so in America, certainly in England. Muslims in England, if you're talking about the Jewish population who want Shechita, maybe... you put it all together, you may get to about 100,000 Jews in England that would be interested. The Muslim population is well over a million, maybe probably even near closer to 2 million. So that's a group of people that are not necessarily going to defend Shechita, but they'll defend ritual slaughter, which they practice in terms of halal meat. So there's kind of an interesting connection there, which may still push away that evil day when Shechita is finally... stopped in England, which I still believe is going to happen, because it's one of those things that just doesn't go away. It's a debate which, if you read the literature about it, you'll see. You go back into people have written stuff about this over the years. A lot of what people have been saying is some of it is based in science. A lot of it is based in conjecture. You know, they're guessing and they're not really sure. And very often has been proven. Lord Jacobitz, the chief rabbi of England, when he was chief rabbi, had a very big fight on his hands in the House of Lords, where he sat to protect Shechita. And I just fear that all this is going to come round again in the UK, as I said, and certainly in Holland. It's a really something which is at the moment a very serious problem. So from our perspective, let's sort of turn it the other way around. If we are sort of, saying, well, Shechita is something that we have to practice, let's look at the bigger picture and say, what is our attitude to animals in general? Because if we're really told, and we know there's a halakha, tzar bali chayim, you're not supposed to cause pain to a living animal, then why do we shecht animals at all? Why do we have shechita? Why are we allowed to eat from the flesh of animals? Why aren't we all vegetarians? And you'll say to me, well, that's the way it was meant to be. If you go back to Adam and Eve, they weren't allowed to eat animals in the Garden of Eden. They were eating fruits, and they were eating... You know, it certainly would not work for the Kiddush club. It would be a very boring Kiddush if you couldn't have your kugel and your chulen. But the reality is, you know, with the flesh, without the flesh, with whatever it was, it would be extremely difficult in our lives to consider a world without the possibility for many people, not for everybody, but for many people, not to eat meat. So the question is, how do we square that? How do we understand that? How do we come to terms with the fact that, you know, we're commanded to give animals rights, we've got to worry about animals, and yet at the same time we're allowed to eat animals when necessary? So that's one thing I want to deal with. Before we get to that, I just want to sort of say some of the more obvious things, which everybody knows. I mentioned in davening this morning that there's a famous halacha. And the halacha is, and it says in the pasuk, "Venatati eser besadecha," God promises you, the second paragraph of the Shema, He'll give you food, growth, besadecha, in your field, and then livehem techa, for your animals, v'achalta v'savata, and then you shall eat. So the suggestion is, what comes first? Behem techa, your animal, and then you. Your animal should be given first, and then you come second. And as I mentioned this morning from the kids in Shulchan Aruch, but it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, chapter 167, what is that? Kuf Ayin Zayin. It says then, I'll read the text, "Umakdimim mozan abahema v'avodim l'sudat atzma," includes avonim as well, that if you have people who are servants, who are working for you, one should make sure that the people working for you are fed before you eat your own food, which is important. Certainly the animal should be fed before the person has his own meal. And it's mentioned in the commentary there that Sarche Suda de Osa Lit Om Kodem Shitin Libhemta, you're not allowed to feed yourself before you feed your animal. And this is a halacha. It's not just a good practice, it's not just being a nice person, right? It's not just being a mensch, a good person. It's brought in halacha as being something that we should be very, very aware of. Feeding the animals first. And it's interesting, Yerushalmi, I found this quotation, that you're not even supposed to buy an animal, right? Unless the food is prepared in advance. So I suppose that what am I thinking of when I go with my kids, take my grandchildren, let's say to Disney World, or you take them to a fun fair and they win an animal, like usually a goldfish or something like that. You know, the reality is, according to the halacha, I've got to make sure that I've got some fish food at home before I take the animal home. Could be a goldfish, could be anything. Certainly, if it's anything bigger than that, then that's one of the issues that I have to be aware of. You've got to be prepared. Animals, having animals is a responsibility. And we know this in the society around us. One of the seven laws of Noah, which we believe applies to the non-Jewish world, as well as to us, is the law of observing kindness to animals. So, you know, for our purposes, the whole world is commanded about this. And we know that in the Torah there are various halachot. The famous law we're going to read in a few weeks' time, ki yikarei kan sipo lefanecha, you find a nest, and the mother is hovering over the chicks, then what do you got to do? You send away the mother bird. And again, what is that all about? And just to quote the commentary there, the Chinuch, the Sefer Chinuch says that it would be cruel. It's an act of cruelty to take away the young chick, the chicks, or the eggs even, if the mother is still around. There are many pictures of Gedolei Yisrael in recent years fulfilling this mitzvah. I saw a picture a few weeks ago. Rav Steinman, I think, one of the great Rosh Yeshivas of today, who was actually up on the ladder a few years ago. I think he could do it now. He's in his 90s. I wouldn't suggest that he should do such a thing. But I think if you were someone like that, who was literally being Mekayim in this mitzvah, trying to fulfill the mitzvah, and it was interesting to see. The other famous example is about loading and unloading. All right, you see your animal which is under a burden, and what are you supposed to do? Azov to azov, you're supposed to go and help and unload the animal, because the reality is that animal is suffering. So you go, and what is called porek, you porek et a behema, you unload the animal, you help the person who owns the animal to unload it. There's an extra dimension there, because it depends whether the person is your friend or the person is not your friend. There are extra laws about that, but in general, the Torah is full and goes again and again with the idea of being sensitive to the animal world. Crossbreeding is a classic example again. You know, many crossbreeds today has become with genetic science and everything else, become a big art. And we've got to be careful about that. My favorite halacha is about the grapefruit, which is not what we're talking about, but it's the same idea. Now, we're not supposed to create a grapefruit, which was a crossbreed between whatever it was. My guess is an orange and whatever. I don't know. I'm not sure where the grapefruit came from exactly. But I know the nectarine is an example from recent years. Sorry? A peach and a plum. Now, we're not allowed to make such a thing. But interestingly, the halacha says once it's made, you can benefit. Right? In other words, once it's there, you're not supposed to be the person, the scientist creating it, because that goes against the teva, something which you're creating in nature, which did not exist. But once it's made, then you can actually benefit from it. So nectarines are something that we actually, particularly in Israel, is a very big export from Israel. So again, there's all different examples of putting together, or rather avoiding putting together, in this case, animals which are unequal. If you're plowing a field and you have an ox plowing on one side and you have a donkey on the other side, you can't plow the field with them hitched up together, because it's cruel. One can pull harder than the other, you know, and before you look around, you're inflicting pain, because one animal is stronger, one animal is weaker. And this again is about having sensitivity to animals. So with all of this introduction, we're back to the same question. If we're so worried about animals, why do we eat them? Why don't we just leave them alone and let them sort of exist? And we're commanded to eat them. You know, we have let's put it this way, we have an allowance to eat them. The history of this is fascinating, because of course you look in Breishit, you'll see there, we're told quite clearly, Urudubid Gataya, man is told to rule over the fish of the sea, Ba'of Hashemayim, and the birds, B'chol Chaya, Remesed Al Aretz, and to any animal which crawls on the ground. In other words, man is supposed to dominate the animal kingdom. That was the original biblical requirement. And after the flood, it was spelled out even more so, Morachem v'chitechem, your fear and your control will be on kol chayat ha'aretz, on all the animals of the world. So you're commanded to be in control. The problem was, as they say in Yiddish, a mensch ist schwach, people are weak. And after the flood, it seems to have been a general consensus that people needed some extra nourishment, they needed the extra food. What is called in the Gemara, basa taiva. Basa taiva means that taiva means they wanted it, they desired the meat. And as an allowance, man was allowed to have meat at that time. And of course, that has stayed with us forever and ever, and we are again working on that basis to this very day. But we are told there are conditions. And one of the biggest conditions is that how do you prepare the meat? You've got to prepare it with a proper procedure, which we call shechita. And we know that the shochet has to be so careful, and some of you may either know a shochet, you may have done shechita, I don't know. The preparation of shechita, I always think of the comparison between what I call the shochet that you meet at an abattoir. You know, everyone who's done smicha, become a rabbi, has to go to an abattoir once, which is was not my favorite thing to do, I can tell you that. And you meet the non-Jew who's killing the animals, and you meet the shochet. And the shochet is a bal halacha, the shochet knows his laws, the shochet usually is a very fine individual that the people that I've met over the years. And you meet the animal, the person from the non-Jewish world who kills animals, and it really, these are not nice people. These are people who are really coming from a why they do a job like that, you have to ask yourself questions. You certainly can ask them questions. And there's no question again in my mind that what we're seeing here is that as much as we are allowed and we are given an allowance to use animals and to even consume animals, there has to be a responsibility which is connected to that consumption. Be it in terms of how we kill the animal, be it in terms of how we treat the animal before it's killed. The whole question in many abattoirs was in terms of different harnesses which could be used, which were required to be used. Of course, the big issue with shechita, the anti-shechita rule, which we can't deal with in terms of halacha, is the question of stunning. The non-Jewish world claims that if you stun the animal, it's less painful, right, than killing the animal straight out. And of course, this is a big discussion, and there are different scientific proofs going one way and going the other way. As far as halacha is concerned, we say it very simply that the knife is so incredibly sharp. You know, the shochet has to test it with his nail, and if there's any nick in the knife, he can't use it. It can make the animal actually nevela, it can actually spoil the shechita. Anything that is, anything which is remotely going to affect the shechita causes the whole process to stop. You can't do it. So we are very, very careful about it. We're given permission. We're certainly given an allowance. I would argue maybe out of weakness, maybe we shouldn't have been given the allowance, but we demanded it. We wanted it as human beings. Nowadays, of course, there is the reverse. And so many people are going back to what we call vegetarian and vegan lifestyle, which worries me. I'm just going to sort of an aside. I work in a college in Manhattan, in Barnard College, connected to Columbia. And whenever we get the sign of a girl who's looking extremely thin and, you know, not eating properly, it's almost 9 times out of 10 because they've adopted a diet which, you know, it's either problems of anorexia, which is a whole separate issue by itself, or they're eating vegan. And for young people particularly, I'm not quite sure how vegan has become so popular. I understand their objection to using animals. But you know what? On the other hand, you know, there is a certain amount of nutrition which the body needs. And that worries me. It's a very worrying development in the general world, and it's something which has spilled over into the Jewish world, the whole problem of balanced diets, etc. And I think this is something which is kind of a spin-off of what we're saying. Yes, there are people who on principle will not eat meat, and I respect that. Rav Kook, the famous chief rabbi of Israel, talks about vegetarianism, and he's very pro-vegetarianism. To the point where I think he suggests that Bimota Mashiach will all become vegetarians again. Something I didn't want to announce, but his suggestion is, and it's based on whatever source that he has, that animals will again go back to their pristine condition before we were allowed to eat them and kill them. But that's a separate discussion again. As far as we're concerned, we have been given an allowance. But an allowance with responsibility. Yeah. Yeah, you got no idea. When they make up a menu in my food program that I work at in the college, there is a whole series of symbols after every item. And it's usually symbols which show that the item is vegetarian, it's vegan, or it's, I don't know, there's something else, I don't remember now, different definitions, which now they put on the menu, you know, to make sure that the person knows that they can have this particular item. And it's not just about allergies. If it's allergies, I understand that. But this is not about allergy anymore. This is about, you know, kind of being, I suppose, aware, concerned about these things from the point of view of the young person. But it worries me because, you know, we always believe in balance. The Rambam says, Shvila Zahar. And when it comes to eating, if we're only going to sort of eat one type of food and cut out other types of foods in our diet, particularly when you're young, it has to have an effect. It has to have an effect. I'm not sure whether the effect is positive. I just see, you know, I see issues, I see problems. But that's something, again, for the nutritionists and for the doctors to work out. And it is a problem. It is a problem in our society today where people are very, very aware, young people are particularly so. Right, just maybe when I get a chance to talk to some of the people here from different countries, interesting to see if they're, you know, sort of thinking those lines. And, you know, it's one of the conversations that I'll try and have, come back to you on that. I just want to mention one thing which is amazing. In the 1800s, there was a very great rabbi in Prague called the sefer is known as Noda Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda Landau, his name was. Very famous rabbi in Prague in Czechoslovakia. And he had a question from a gevir. A gevir, a very wealthy man, wrote to him, and he wanted to know the following. Some of you may have heard this before. They wanted to know, are they allowed, they have a big estate, all right? They have a lot of land. I can just picture sort of like, you know, this whole area around here, full of animals running around, deer, and who knows what they had. And this guy was obviously a religious man, and he wanted to know, can he go hunting? Can he take his shotgun, and can he go and shoot the animals? And he obviously, the suggestion is that he was doing it possibly for pleasurable reasons. You know, it's one of those pastimes that rich people do. Or maybe also to keep down the problem, because if these animals get too many, they overrun your crops and whatever, it's a problem. And he wanted to know what exactly the rabbi thought. Would he be allowed to go hunting? Now the rabbi was in a delicate position, because from the way that he writes his response, it's clear that this man was a very big supporter of the yeshiva. All right, you can't say no to this guy if he's supporting your yeshiva, because, you know, then your donation dries up. You've got to be careful about this. On the other hand, what do you say to the guy? So Rabbi Landau was very smart. He said, listen, we all know, we all learn Torah. Who are the people who are given the title, the honor of hunters? All right, two people in the Torah that we can refer to. Neither of which we really are very excited about. One guy is called Nimrod, and the other guy is called Esau. They're both hunters, right? They both went out to hunt animals. So Rav Landau says that these are not people that we look up to as our role models. So he is very against this. He says to the person, I'll just quote this because this is fascinating. He says like this. He says, "V'lechein hashomea li yishkom beta." He says, you know what? Better to stay at home. Don't go hunting. Stay at home. Don't waste your time with these things. If you need to cull the animals, then send your people. But for you to go and do this, and to go, you know, in England, to go fox hunting and all this crazy stuff, for a person who is sensitive to these issues, the answer is no. And he says it in such a way that it's very, very smart the way he presents it. He doesn't say osa and sort of scream at the guy. He brings examples before he says to the man, don't do it. He says, just think about who did it and then realize that this is not, as they say, it's pasnish. It's not one of the things that we should be doing. And I found that very fascinating, very, very challenging that somebody, number one, would have had so much land in those days that they asked the question. I remember visiting the cemetery in Warsaw on a trip to Poland that I took students, must be now 15 years ago. And as one of the biggest matsevas there that you have is a matseva of a gevir. It's a gentleman who on the matseva they put a map of the land that he owned in his estate. And it literally was an enormous, enormous estate. And it just, you know, when you see that, you begin to realize that as much as we hear about Polish Jewry being in so much poverty and so many difficulties, there were a number of Jews who were extremely, extremely wealthy in those days. And to put it on a matseva is very extreme. It's very extreme. Nowadays, thank God, people don't do that, but you know, they can leave their bequest to the yeshiva. They'll get a name on the wall, or they'll get a building named after them, or something like that. That's okay. But thinking about someone who would leave a matseva with that particular image is striking. But you've got it here. The Note of Yehuda writes about this gentleman who wrote to him, can I go fox hunting or can I go animal hunting? And the answer was, don't do it. Don't waste your time. So again, this is very much part of what we're saying. Yes, animals do exist, but we have to have a certain amount of responsibility towards the animal world. Yeah.
Somebody asked Professor Einstein, how do you find who's a Jew who said doesn't enjoy hunting?
And doesn't, that's what he said, really.
Hey, so I don't know that it's true, but
yeah,
yeah. I read it many times.
Yeah, I find it very difficult just to get my head around what pleasure is there in going to kill animals. I don't.
Very rare.
Jews wouldn't do it. I mean, again, in England, it was exclusive. It was the aristocracy, and the Jews were not part of that. I imagine the old Jewish families in England, you know, the Rothschilds would have done it, I guess, because they had to join in. Nowadays, it's golf, so you have to play golf. Okay, so golf is a bit easier. You don't have to kill any. Well, you might kill something, but you've got to be careful where you hit the ball. But, you know, it's not as bad. All right, but in those days, to join the aristocracy, you've got to go hunting. But that's what it is. It's crazy. So it's a very strange. Yeah, and foxes, or they shoot birds, or whatever it may be. Crazy. Yeah, yeah. Tzar Bali Chaim, I don't even have to go into, because it's a principle that is enumerated. I'll just read again what the Chinuch says. Tamei HaMitzvah, what's the reason of the mitzvah? Asur min HaTorah, that this is forbidden to cause animals pain. V'yodua she'esh l'minei behema v'ofas daga gadol. He says that we argue that animals feel some sort of emotional response, some sort of reaction to pain. And he says, im she'en minon. He's talking, for instance, where two animals will be plowing and they're not equal in size or different animals completely. And he says that causes pain and grief. And he uses the word daga. Daga means worry. You know, animals start getting worried about this thing. I mean, it's an unbelievable thing that he says it. And therefore, as a principle, we are, again, very, very careful, very sensitive to the concept of animals and animal welfare. If I haven't made the case till now, obviously, that there are many, many examples that are brought about different places where it talks about animals having feelings, and I don't want to go through all that again, but I think that point is well made. One of the big issues of the late 20th century, going into the 21st century, and this is something that a lot of ladies will be aware of, is the whole question of animal experimentation. Animal experimentation has been around for a number of years, particularly for things like cosmetics, for things like new products which people might have to ingest, might have to eat. The whole question of using an animal to test the product. Now again, this is a very serious question. Rav Waldenberg, Zichron Livrocha, one of the great rabbis in Israel over the last, literally last 40 years, only passed away 2 or 3 years ago, wrote a very interesting response about this. And his argument is that it depends. If you're testing using the animal for the sake of the human being, in other words, this is like a medication, which you need to absolutely be certain that this medication will not cause harm, side effects, or whatever it may be, then it's an animal which is being used for the purpose of bettering society, bettering human condition, and he's prepared to allow it. But he says, if you've got a company which is using animals purely for cosmetics, producing, you know, that type of product, he says, absolutely forbidden. And I think they even have on many cosmetics now some sort of stempel, some sort of mark. You know, it's not a kashrus thing. It's a mark saying that this product was made without testing or without using animals in any way. This is what I believe. I think I've seen this on a number of products. And certainly from a Jewish perspective, that is something really important. What do I tell you? I have to tell you the story. The story goes like this, and it's a story about a very great rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Judah the Prince, famous, famous rabbi. And the Gemara says like this, what happened was, he was walking along one day, and he saw an egle, he saw an animal, like a very young, I suppose nowadays you would call it like a young calf, being led to the shechita, going to be slaughtered. And it says that what happened, it says that the animal was kind of, the head was bowed. It was, the animal was showing a kind of negative feeling towards what was just about to happen to the animal. And Rebbe, the famous Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, he went over to the animal and he bent over and he whispered in the animal's ear. Very interesting story. And it says that, what did he say to the animal? Zil, he said, go, lekach notzarta. This is what you were created to be. You were created to be slaughtered, to be used, you know, to provide steak and whatever for people who want it. That was, I suppose, a realistic approach, but from Rebbe they expected more. And what happened? The Gemara goes on, ho v'lo kamarachin. He was not kind to this animal, because he said something which was considered to be harsh. It says that he had terrible yisurin. He suffered for many years from terrible, terrible affliction. It says that his stomach, he had terrible problem. I think somebody said nowadays we would actually say he suffered from stomach cancer. That's what he had, and he was in terrible pain. And the Gemara brings an interesting thing. It says that what happened was that another day came along, many years later, when it says that the servant, the woman who used to work in the house of the great rabbi, she said, what happened, that she was sweeping, it says, kansha, she was sweeping the floor. And it says that what happened is that there were animals running around. I think that they were, you know, picking up whatever pieces they could. And Omar La, and what the rabbi said to this maid is Shafkinu, he said to her, leave them alone. These animals are, you know, they want to eat something. There's whatever, there may have been some nuts or something on the floor. Allow them to eat. And he said, it's a pasuk, Rachamava kol ma'asav. We said every day, his mercy is on his creatures. And at that point, Rebbe did tshuva. It says that at that point, it says that he was merciful to the animals, so God was merciful to him. Unbelievable. Now again, this is living on a madrega, which we can't imagine, that someone should be punished for saying a word like this to an animal, is something we find very hard to understand. But the expectation of this great rabbi is that he has to live and breathe this concept of responsibility to the animal world. And if he can set an example of showing a kindness, saying a kind word, being more, as they say, rahmanas, to have a more merciful attitude, then that is something which we believe is important, certainly for a Jewish leader. I've got a picture at home of a very famous rabbi, Rabbi Eliel Lopion. And I think you're connected, related. And there's a picture of him giving a cat some milk. You know the photo that I mean? Have you ever seen this? He's feeding a cat. And it's a beautiful photo. This old rabbi, he wore all the rabbinical clothing or whatever. And he's just leaning over and he's giving the cat a bowl of milk. And this is became a family photo, one of the favorite photos in the Mishpacha. And it's actually, I think it's reprinted in one of the books about the rabbi. And again, it's an interesting, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, what was he doing at the time that he was feeding the animal. To me, it's kind of obvious, but what we've just been saying, that this was a man, Rabbi Eliel Lopion, as a great Jewish leader in his day, you know, he lived this, he understood this. He understood that as much as he's there to inspire us as human beings, he's also there to respect the animal world. And the argument is a very simple argument. When you give cover to God's creatures, hopefully you'll give cover to your fellow man. If you don't respect the animal world, then there's something wrong. There's a sign that maybe you're not going to respect your fellow human being as well. Now, again, this obviously is not is very a general comment, but it's something that I think we're aware of, and it's proven to a certain extent by David and by Moshe. And this is really the final thought. The final thought is as follows. David and Moshe, what were they before they became leaders? They were shepherds. All right. Moshe, according to some, he was a shepherd for many, many years. 60 years. David was out in the field for 28, 29 years till he was brought in eventually to be crowned as the king. He was 28 years old. So he'd been a shepherd for most of his life. What was he doing all day apart from sort of composing Tehillim and doing all that stuff? What was Moshe doing all day when he was working for Yisro for so many years? The answer is that, and the Gemara puts it so beautifully, it's a Midrash. Midrash talks about Moshe, and I'll just give you one example of what it says here. It says that Moshe, one of the things he saw, that there was a pool of water, all right, which was in the distance. And he saw that there was one of the animals that he was looking after, wanted to drink. And the animal was, you know, sort of obviously going off in that direction. And Moshe says the following. This is Moshe Rabbeinu. It says, Amar, he said, Ani lo ayiti yodea, sheratz ayitam ibnei tzameh. I didn't know that you were running over there, right? He says to the animal, it must be because you're very thirsty, but that obviously means you're very tired because you haven't had anything to drink. So he says, Harakiva akhtefo, he took the animal on his shoulders. And he went, malach, and he went over to the pool of water and put the animal down, gave the animal to drink. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. Omar Kodesh Baruch Hu, so the Medrash says beautifully, it says, God said, Yesh lecha rachamim, you have mercy, linhok tzono shal basav adam, to treat animals like this, then chayecha, by your life, you will be the shepherd of tzoni Yisrael, my flock of Israel, meaning the Jewish people. There is a certain middah, there's a certain positive element there, which clearly is something that is very, very significant if one exhibits it. And one feels it, one feels with God's creatures, and eventually, of course, we understand that hopefully becomes something you exhibit and you feel towards your fellow man. And I would add, be they Jewish or not Jewish, you know, we have an obligation to respect our fellow man in the world that we live. That's a separate discussion. My comment at the end, of course, is the question about zoos. As somebody put it to me, is it gum zoo latovo or is it zoo lolatovo? In the case of a zoo, I've never been a big fan of zoos. I don't know if you've ever visited these places. London Zoo is famous. It's like in London, probably the biggest zoo in the world. And you know, again, I think it's like a double-edged sword. On the one hand, there is a responsibility towards the animal, and I think you see that in the bigger zoos, which are well-funded and the animals are well looked after. But there's still this thought in the back of my mind that if we really respected these animals, we would let them, you know, run around in their natural habitat. To be in England where it rains literally almost 365 days a year, for an animal that should be living in Africa in the hot sun, I've always felt there was a question about that, and I've never been comfortable with that. So I'm not a great fan of zoos. Some of you, I don't know, may disagree with me on that. So from a Jewish point of view, I think what we're saying here, and again, I wanted to start off with something which I think a lot of you know already, but it needs to just to be heard again. What we are not, we're not Bilam. We're not, certainly not someone who will take a stick and hit an animal for the sake of hitting an animal. Our reaction to animals should be positive, should be respectful. And of course, we have to protect ourselves from a wild animal, or an animal that is trained to damage. You know, the Germans reared dogs, and these were the most vicious animals in the world. And there's no question there that if one could protect oneself from such terrible oppressors like that, one has to. Then that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking here about people who, and certainly animals that one can respect. And as a consequence, the real deal about this whole thing is that the feeling you have towards the animal, hopefully, is translated into a feeling towards your fellow man. And on that basis, I certainly feel this is an important subject to be aware of. You know, one of those things that maybe is not spoken about very often, but I think is certainly worth spending a few minutes, certainly Parshas Bilam, Parshas Balak, thinking about that for tomorrow's Parsha as well. Any questions? Any comments? Yeah.
Why did
it say that he's supposed to be Yeah. Regalim, because there's a reference there. You know, Regalim, because the whole thing was to bring against the Jewish people, right? You know, who observe three regalim. It's a reference to the regal, meaning the food festival, the Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. So the word is used there very, very specifically to show that really that the donkey, or certainly the way it's presented, the whole story was underlined. What was underneath the story was the attempt to go and curse the Jewish people, which was foiled all the way along. Bilam is a very strange guy. He is what do they call him today? Bipolar. You know, he's going in two directions all at the same time. Because he wants to please God, but he wants to curse Am Yisrael. And eventually he understands, you know, I'm never going to get away with this, but he's devious. He's terribly devious. I'll talk about that more tomorrow, in the Drosha. We'll talk about Bilam tomorrow. Any other comments? Thank you for listening. I hope that sort of got your thoughts going. On Sunday, please God, we'll talk a bit about business ethics. As I said, feet on the ground. A few of the issues in business which one comes across. And again, more of a sort of general picture that Mirza Shem will develop next week. Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Thank you.